The phrase America, love it or leave it, is often used to shut down conversations about this country's flaws. If you think about it, it has the ring of a toxic relationship, doesn't it? Like some gaslighting narcissist who tries to convince you to stay with them because nobody else would ever want you. People who break free of abusive partners often realize in hindsight there were red flags from the very beginning. Red flags they failed to see because they were blinded by love and focused on trying to keep their partner happy. Tiffany Drayton sees parallels in her relationship to the United States as a Black woman and an immigrant. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Drayton left Trinidad and Tobago at the age of 7 for New Jersey, where her mother was working hard to give her kids a better life. The family later lived in Texas and Florida, and in each place, Drayton tried her best to follow all the rules to be deemed worthy of success and happiness in her new country. But she never felt truly valued or understood until she returned to Trinidad and found herself freed from the illogical but unbreakable rules of white supremacy. She writes about this in her memoir, Black American Refugee, Escaping the Narcissism of the American Dream. Tiffany, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me. And I must say that was the best intro I've experienced to date.
Oh, I'm so happy to hear that. Well, I really enjoyed reading the book. I mean, it's a hard read in a lot of ways, but fascinating just the same. It's such a startling metaphor that for Black people, living in the U.S. is a lot like living with an abusive partner, starting with the beginning of the cycle, which has sometimes been referred to as the love bomb phase. How did the love bomb phase of life in the U.S. play out for you?
Yeah, you know, I distinctly remember being a little girl and flying over the New York City skyline with my little brother when we were first arriving to, you know, the shores of the United States. And my brother saw the skyline and he swore that the entire of New York City was lit up just for him, right? And that's kind of that scene kind of set the tone of how I would view myself in America for a very long time, where I internalized all of these messages like, you know, you come to America and you work hard, and once you work hard, you can be successful, and you pull yourself up by your bootstraps, and the land of the free and democracy. And then, you know, especially as you're being educated in the United States of America, you're told all of these different narratives about what the Statue of Liberty means, and that it's a welcome beacon for all immigrants who can work their way up, right?
What had your mom told you guys about why she made this move and wanted you to join her?
You know, my mom was really seeking just a new life after her breakup with my father. And so, you know, America just posed this, you know, also being a woman of the 90s and the 80s, American culture was just all over the world. And everybody thought that that same exact narrative where, you know, you can go to the United States of America and find freedom and make a new life for yourself. So that's really what brought her here.
So you initially settled in North Bergen, New Jersey. What sort of place was it when you were a kid there?
Oh, North Bergen was just one of those towns that really deserve its own Hollywood coming of age story. It was one of, you know, when all of the kids go out in the daytime and don't come back home until the sun goes down. That's pretty much what North Bergen was. It was a very small, bustling immigrant town, not too far away from New York City. So kind of sort of like a suburb, but kind of sort of not. And all of the kids would be out playing all day and night. And it had police officers riding around on bicycles. It was just one of those quintessential towns that made you feel entirely welcomed as a small child and as an immigrant child.
So at that time, you write, Blackness just felt like a fact of your life, not necessarily something that would ever be an impediment to you. Do you have the sense now that at that moment, it felt very different for your mom already?
Oh, you know, she was kind of receiving these mixed messages because, you know, for her coming to the United States of America, she had to find, where do I fit into this all? And the first recommendation was for her to become a nanny, because most women from the West Indies came to America and became nannies. So that was the first job that she ever had. And I remember her telling me, you know, when I got older, that it was almost impossible for her to believe that Black people in America had other jobs, because working in that position and working for primarily white families, you rarely saw Black people doing other work, especially when you're living in a home with and being employed by white folks. She just felt like that was the only thing Black people could do. But yet simultaneously, the 90s was just this era of just Black culture being just this pervasive experience for her. So, she listened to Toni Braxton and the Brownstones, and we all watched Fresh Prince of Bel-Air and Family Matters. So our and the Cosbys. So it's like a weird sense, like her understanding of Blackness came through these two kind of diametrically opposed experiences, where on one end, all Black people are like the servants of white people. And then on the other end, Black people are creating the culture and the music and just these beacons of light and success and entertainment.
It must have been so painful for her taking care of other people's children when she was in this country and doing this work so that she could be reunited with her own kids.
Yeah, it really was. And as I got older, and I went to school in New York City, and I would see these women, and I would think of my mom, where I'm seeing these Black women pushing these strollers with the little white babies, and I'm like, oh, that was my mom. And it was really it because for so long, she became a nurse, so I had disassociated that type of experience from her because I didn't know her in that role. By the time we came to America, she had already started nursing school and was working at a bank. So I didn't really think of her as a nanny. But as I got older, I just my heart breaks every time I see it because I know a lot of these women have to leave their own kids behind to perform those duties for these families who oftentimes don't even value them as they should.
So she gets her nursing degree. She moves the family to Houston in search of better housing because it would be more affordable there. But even before you arrived in Texas at this hotel along the route, you got your first taste of what it really meant to be, as you write, Black in the United States of White America. What happened?
Absolutely. We first started getting our inclinations that the rest of the United States of America was not like North Bergen, even when we just started leaving the town, going to the neighboring town, Edison, which was mostly white or Asian. And my aunt lived there, and there would always be like this whisper, like, shh, don't be too loud, don't pick up too much space. And then when my mom did finally decide to move, that idea of like conforming to whiteness and the dangers even of the policing of whiteness just became so glaringly apparent where, we would stop at a hotel in this one instance. And, me and my brother, we went out to play in the hotel's pool, and there were these white women just like peering over their patio at us and like talking amongst themselves. And when some other Black kids came to join us, we were just splashing and having the time of our lives, right? We were so happy. And my mom stumbled on the scene, and immediately when she saw these women watching us, she was like, oh God, not this. And as a child, you don't even realize, or I took for granted that my mother read the scene so clearly, that she knew these white women weren't concerned for us in a way that was friendly, that it was more a matter of, what are these Black kids doing here? And so I didn't understand that at the time, but I definitely came to understand it as I got older, that my mom had to protect us from this constant policing of whiteness.
School also felt really different in Houston. Your teachers objected when you submitted this history report that examined the actual life of Pocahontas rather than the sanitized version.
Yes, precisely. It was just when, your teacher gives you an assignment. For me, I always loved history and I love research. So when I got this history assignment where my teacher's like, just research your favorite historical figure, the first thing I thought about was the Disney character Pocahontas, because I love that movie. And it's this tale of love, and it's this perfect love story, and I love love stories too. I'm just this little girl that's entirely enamored by the whole thing. And however, when I go to do the research on what the story actually was, this is when computers were just big, and I went to the school's computer lab, and I sit there and I'm like, well, this isn't a Disney movie at all. Like, this is horrible. So partially enraged, but also empowered by knowing the truth, I decided to give this report to my teacher, and she was so highly offended. And she's like, wait a minute, where did you get this? And I'm like, in the library? And she's like, did you use the library's resources? And I was like, the computer? But apparently I wasn't supposed to use the computer. I'm not sure what resources I was supposed to use, but the computer and the internet was not the source. So it was at that moment I distinctly remember, and it was so clear to me that the truth, the real truth, not the sanitized, watered down version, was something that was highly problematic to even speak about.
Meanwhile, your brother told his teacher in Texas he wanted to go to Harvard Law School. And rather than encouraging him, not only did she tell him there was no way he'd get in, she then proceeded to tell your mom that if your brother happened to get in, it would be because he was stealing a place from her son because of affirmative action. And to her credit, your mom was not having that.
Oh, no. You know, my mom is just, oh, God, she's just a firecracker. And even my brother is. And it was so, you know, in my family, we just learned to turn everything into a joke. So I remember my mom coming home and telling us about this meeting that she had with the principal and the teacher. And she told us about that moment when this lady has the nerve to bring up affirmative action. And it's like, my brother was an A student. I was an A student. You know, my whole family, we really prided ourselves on being nerds. We were just these huge nerds. And it's like, how dare you diminish our achievements and accomplishments and intelligence to affirmative action? But that became such a common theme. Like, there's always a reason why a Black person occupies a space. It's not simply because they're intelligent. It's because we're taking the place of white folks who more readily deserve it, you know? And it was very, very heartbreaking.
So after 4 challenging years in Houston, you were relieved when your mom decided to move to Florida. She made sure to settle within what was considered a good school district. But that meant very few of the kids in your honors classes day to day were Black. What did that feel like?
Yeah, it was so isolating. And it was just at that point, even a bit of a common theme, because we had recognized through doing research prior to moving that, you know, good school equals mostly white school, bad school equals mostly Black school. So then realizing that applied to your classroom, even, it was just this harsh blow. And, you know, anytime you get hit with something super traumatizing, I've realized looking back, you just get really numb and confused. So you're just in this state of shock. And I really wasn't able to make sense of much of that until well into my adulthood.
Florida had this deal at the time, I guess, where students who had a 3.5 GPA and did a certain amount of community service in high school would be able to attend a local university for free. Where were you placed initially to do that community service?
Oh, yeah. I remember going to my counselor and I'm like, I need placement so I can do these hours. And she's like, oh, I know the perfect place for you. And she sends me to a school that had trailers and that was overgrown. And, you know, as I'm walking in, I'm like, I could barely even recognize this environment because it was so unlike anything I was accustomed to. And even driving into the neighborhood, it was just a rundown neighborhood. You can tell it had mostly minorities. And then walking into the school and even getting the student that I was in charge of tutoring, you just get this overwhelming sense that, like, everything here is wrong. And it was at that moment I realized it was a Black school. And what that meant was that, well, firstly, that teacher figured just because I'm Black, I should do my community service at a Black school. But also, that Black school was barely recognizable to me as a school, which was, you know, in the most powerful country in the world. It was like, how is this even possible?
We should say all the other girls on your tennis team, who were mostly white, were literally given their community service at a country club.
Yes, that, yeah. And I came to find out after I was outraged about this placement, like, why would you send me, aside from the fact that it was in a rundown neighborhood, it was like 45 minutes away. And, you know, back to my mom being a single parent, she would have to drive me there. And my brother decided to do the same placement just to get to the school. And so I marched into the counselor's office. I'm like, I don't want to go back there. It's too far. This school is horrible. Why are you sending me here? And she was like, well, what else do you like? I'm like, well, I play tennis. And she was like, oh, you're on the tennis team. And I disclosed to her I was on the tennis team. And she's like, well, I had no idea. And it was then that I realized the tennis girls had their own community service at a country club, or, you know, picking up balls for the country club and having parties and planning parties, and it was and also handing out sandwiches during the neighborhood marathons and things of this nature. So it was at that point I was like, oh, so there's white community service and then there's black community service. Two very different experiences.
It sounds like you've had a lot of ambivalent thoughts in the years that followed about the kid you were initially assigned to.
You have to really distance yourself from that sense of hardship or the idea that everything is failed in an environment. And, the child I was assigned, he was 7, 8 years old and could barely even hold a pencil. And it was like, how? How are you in a school? And this is the case. And I remember distinctly, like, the principal explaining to me, that the child, like his parents were on drugs, and the environment was such a harsh environment. He was like, just being there, just having your presence means a lot. But for me, being there meant I had to contend with this just a very painful scenario that children really shouldn't even be exposed to, let alone have to live through. So I just put a lot of distance between that and myself, both physically and emotionally, as much as possible.
Tiffany, how did your proximity in Florida to a lot of wealthier white friends affect the way you felt about your body?
Body image is one of those things you don't realize is so controlled by your what you see around you. And at the time, everything I saw around me was everybody was white, and they were all, what I would say, like little tiny white girls. And I'm this very strong, not tiny at all, black girl. And I would look at my legs. We would be like in a circle doing our stretches, and I would look at my legs, and my legs just look huge compared to theirs. And I'm like, your point of comparison are people who are not like you. And at that time, I didn't think of it that way. I just thought of it like something's wrong with me because I'm not like the rest of everybody else. And so that agonizing sense of something being wrong with you physically, because your point of reference is are people who are not who do not look like you at all. It gives you a terrible, you just look at yourself as something's wrong with you.
I mean, it takes us back to that metaphor that you base the book around of an abusive relationship. If someone tells you often enough that you're not beautiful, you're going to absorb that, whether it's true or not.
Absolutely. And people don't realize, you don't have to even say it outright. There doesn't need to be a statement like, you're ugly or you're not beautiful. You just need to normalize someone else's beauty. And if yours doesn't fit into that norm, as a young person, even children aren't dumb. They understand what we normalize as beauty. And if they don't see themselves in what is considered normal or classically beautiful, then they're not going to view themselves that way. So for all of the body positivity that America promises to push, it's like body positivity is not really necessary. What's just necessary is representation so that all bodies are normalized. And that way, we don't need to think that we need to create a special space for other types of bodies, because that means, well, we're already othering them. Why not just have all bodies be normal and beautiful?
So your early life was this cycle of believing in America and that things were really getting better and then getting knocked back to the ground by reality. Your family moved back to New Jersey. Your school wasn't great, but you were heartened by the way your classmates ultimately accepted a teacher's gender transition. And you thought, well, maybe America really is changing. What did you hope that might mean for you?
Oh, when my teacher transitioned from male to female, there were two things. Like, it was so beautiful to watch her blossom, right? Because we went from having this very, like, meek, soft-spoken teacher that could not command this classroom, and the class was just entirely abusive towards him, to, when he transitioned and became our teacher, and became a woman, she was just phenomenal, and she would just put all of the kids in their place. And for me, it was like, oh, wait a minute, you can claim space and you can claim your dignity. And that was affirmed. So all of the teachers in the environment and the principal, they were like, listen, this is what it is, have respect. And that was the code of ethics and the code of honor. And so I was like, wait a minute, can I do that too? Can I pick up space and claim space and be treated with dignity too? So it was like a light bulb moment where I was like, wait, this also applies to me. And then, well, probably not.
I mean, you kept, you had friends, families who made it really clear that you were not welcome in their homes, and the only reason for that was because you were black. And then your friends would insist you were the one who was wrong. It was wrong for you to get upset. You were being too sensitive. And what you did in response was, for a while, try to pretend it didn't hurt you and try to believe them that you were somehow overreacting.
Oh, yeah, because it's just this perpetual gaslighting, perpetual gaslighting. And what my friends were doing to me in trying to deny the hurtfulness of somebody outright saying to your face, you cannot hang out with this person because you are black. I don't want my child in your house because you're black and your family's black. That somehow isn't supposed to hurt you. Why? Well, because according to the TV, America's colorblind and we don't see color and it's not that big a deal. And maybe those people are just stupid. Or, why are you pretending that that hurts you? Like, you're not supposed to feel anything about that. So my friends were treating me in the same exact way that America was treating its entire populace, just constantly and consistently gaslighting us. Like, there's no racism. Look, Barack Obama's president. Why are you so upset? You just have to work hard like him. You'll be like him. And my friends did the same exact thing.
Your uncle had built this successful business in the New Jersey suburbs, but he actually had to pretend he just worked there rather than letting his white customers know he owned the place.
Oh, yeah, they were so outraged by the idea that my uncle owned it. And my family quickly recognized that because my aunt would work at the store and my cousin worked at the store. And occasionally you have like a misunderstanding with a customer, or a customer wants like some service or something that they think they're not getting from you, and they'll say, well, can I speak to your manager? Can I speak to your owner? And this is a small town. So at first, my aunt would be like, I am the manager. The owner is my husband. Like, what do you want? And they just wouldn't come back. And so she realized this was actually a matter of the survival of her business. And he quickly realized that too. Like, if we continue to like do a power flex, like, what, we own this. Like, who are you going to talk to? Like, this is it. Like, we have to work it out. Just the idea that there were these black people with this power in this mostly white community was so outrageous to the community that they realized immediately, like, we need to shut that down and not even say anything. Just pretend, don't even say anything.
And then around that time, your aunt invited you to return to Trinidad for Carnival. And you say that trip was the beginning of your journey into Black womanhood. Tell us a little bit about what made it so noteworthy for you.
It was so powerful to land in a country where the majority of people are black and brown. Because all of a sudden, there was this absence of this whiteness that I had learned to conform to. And I realized, one of the things I realized immediately, I like to go out and run. And I would go out and run around my neighborhood. And I ran around so many neighborhoods in America with my headphones on and, just on my mission. And when I tried to do the same thing in Trinidad, I was constantly interrupted. To the point where I was like, why are these people talking to me? And they would be saying good morning, good evening, good afternoon, and I would be offended. Like, why are they looking at me? Why are they talking to me? And it was at some point that a woman was like she literally yelled at me, like, you don't know how to say good morning? And I was like, oh, well, that, I guess it's true. Like, I should have been acknowledging other humans existing, but it came crashing down on me for so long. Nobody had ever acknowledged me. And for the first time, I was being acknowledged everywhere I went. And that to me was one of the most reckoning and powerful moments as a black woman.
What did the first black college professor you ever had help you understand about this abusive relationship you had formed with the United States?
Well, I guess he was like my country counselor, my country therapist. Because at the point where I was in college and I took this class with an amazing professor, Derek Hamilton, amazing economist. Everybody should check him out. I did not even know what racism or systemic racism was. I was like, what is that? I don't, you know, I had all of these experiences, but I was not able yet to acknowledge that it was part of a larger system of oppression that was doing things to me. You know, I hadn't identified I was in an abusive relationship yet. Mm-hmm. And that's what that class did. That class forced me to sit with history and to read statistics and to understand that these experiences I was having, like being forced from one neighborhood to the next and constantly priced out. It's like, there's a word for that. It's called gentrification. You know, the fact that schools are underfunded in Black communities. Well, there's a word for that. It's called redlining, you know, where, you know, certain Black folks don't have access to white wealthy neighborhoods and thus the taxes to fund good schools. So he provided me not only with the language, but with the context to finally see what systemic racism meant and to be forced to say, wait, I'm in this abusive dynamic. I'm a part of this system too.
Meanwhile, this other professor you had, you scored an interview as a college student with the author Junot Diaz, and all that instructor could notice was Diaz's brilliance without, like, acknowledging that the questions you crafted had elicited those answers.
Oh, yeah, you know, and that was at the tail end of this education in a predominantly white institution where anytime I had an opinion, it was like, be quiet, Black girl. Mm. Or anytime I thing that, you know, was too far outside of the confines of what was supposed to be acceptable, respectable, I was always shut down. And in this instance, you know, I went out of my way and I worked so hard on this interview. If I could tell you, I think I lost sleep over it because I just loved Junot Diaz. And I just, you know, he said all of these powerful things about systemic racism and about the Dream Act and Barack Obama. And, you know, I took my time to craft those questions. And when I turned in the assignment, the professor, a white man, was like, you know, he did a great job answering this. You know, it just really flowed together, you know? And I was like, I'm the one that wrote those questions. I'm the one that did this interview. I was so outraged that I never even finished it. I was like, yeah, you could just go right to hell, okay, sir?
So on graduation day, you announced to your family you are leaving the U.S. and you felt like Trinidad welcomed you back with open arms. Tell us a little bit about what is different about day-to-day life in a place where the racial hierarchy is just not a thing.
It's so freeing and peaceful. I think it's the peacefulness, really, of knowing you can walk outside in any neighborhood and not feel the burning stares or glares of people who are policing your presence. Or, you know, you can go to any park with your kids and they can run and play freely and all of the other kids are going to play with them and not whisper about them with their parents. Or just, you just feel like you can just like stretch out so far and pick up all the space you want and not have to be feeling constantly threatened or this sense of anxiety just looming all the time. It's just an incredible feeling to not have to deal with any of that.
I wonder if it also makes it easier for you to know yourself as Tiffany Drayton, the individual, when you don't have to ask yourself, well, is this a thing about me because I'm Black or is this a thing about me because I'm American? Suddenly, those aren't part of what you have to ask yourself.
No, it, you know, and moving from one environment to another always begs the question, well, who am I? Certainly, because, well, every environment is different. And it's beautiful that when you move out of a white environment, who am I is no, the answer to that question is no longer in opposition to or juxtaposed to whiteness. It's who am I in a country full of other Black and brown people, in a history that's regarded and respected, that's also full of brown people, in a political system that's run by brown and Black people. That who am I question can be so much, you have more room to answer that question and not have so many limits just because who am I happens to also be Black.
You have also experienced an abusive romantic relationship, and we really haven't had a chance to talk about that today, but I wonder what that experience has taught you. about why it can be so hard to leave even after the point that you recognize that something is not working and may actually be dangerous for you.
Oh, absolutely. Well, one of the most damning and saddening lessons I've been forced to learn in so many ways is that, you know, the point at which a victim recognizes they're in an abusive relationship, and even the point at which they decide that they want to leave, that can be the most dangerous part of the cycle of abuse. So for many women who have been caught in cycles of abuse, or anybody, I feel saddened by the loss of life in this context even. So there is that reality that escaping abuse is not easy, and everyone must confront that. And it requires finances, it requires resources, it requires like so many things from a victim who has already been beaten down, bruised, you know. And I think one of the main things that I've taken away from experiencing, escaping, enduring, whatever you want to call it, abuse, is that it has, I've had the fortune of having all of those things, of having the resources, of having support systems, of having, you know, so many people to turn to. And that is crucial for us as a society to realize, like, if we want to truly end systemic abuses, we need to be providing resources, and we need to be true allies, etc.
So you are raising your children in Trinidad. What do you tell them about your life in the U.S. and how it has shaped who you are now?
The truth is that I will never be able to exclusively raise my children in Trinidad because, you know, their father is from America. So, and not only that, but because one must experience, sadly, the extent of the world that we live in. And it's not always, you're not always going to be protected. And fortunately, my children are only 3 and 4, but still, in only being 3 and 4, the experiences that they will be forced to endure as Black people, as Black children, especially in this era, in this very tenuous era, there are no words that I can say that can prepare them, especially because, quite frankly, I barely even know. The only thing that I can say is this era has forced a much needed reckoning. And so I have faith in those allies once again, and in those superheroes that are going to pop up and make their future a brighter one.
After you have been in an abusive, after one has been in an abusive romantic relationship, it's not necessarily easy to stop loving your abuser, and people may not fully understand this. But I wonder, in the context that, you know, you were in an abusive relationship with the United States, is it hazardous for your mental health to allow yourself to feel any affection for the U.S. and for the years of your life here?
You know, The primary problem is that I don't ever feel anything about it, which to me speaks to how extensive the trauma must be, because it's like, how could I live in a country for all those years and feel no way about it? And most, if I do feel a way, it's usually like, oh God, I'm so glad that I don't have to live there. I don't have to deal with that crap. It shouldn't be that way. But ultimately, I don't believe a country is defined only by its governing institutions. I think that a country is defined by its people. And it's at that ground level, you know, where my friends are, where my families are, my mentors, so on and so forth. These are the folks that I will always believe in and always have faith in. And I just hope that they find that strength to unify and cast out the abusers at every level that are making it, that it's unbearable to be an American at this point.
Do you have any message for the people who maybe are trying to do this, may not succeed for a long time, and aren't in a position to leave and make lives elsewhere?
Absolutely. The message is one, I want to really reinforce what I said already. Like, this is the time to rise. You know, this is the time to unify. This is a time of global reckoning. Like, this is not an era like any we've ever seen before. So what gives me hope is these types of conversations that are establishing firm ground. Like, we know where we stand. We know what the problems are. And now what is now the question being begged of us is, so what are we going to do about it? And I know for a fact, many people are working very hard to ensure that there is a better tomorrow. And I'm a part of that fight, too. And I'll never stop being a part of that fight. So I just call everyone to action.
Tiffany Drayton is a journalist and author of the memoir Black American Refugee, Escaping the Narcissism of the American Dream. Tiffany, I've really enjoyed talking with you. Thanks very much for making time for us.
Oh, thank you so much. It was such a pleasure.
You can find us on Twitter at the handle at KERAThink, and you can subscribe to our podcast wherever you get podcasts. You can find it by searching for KERAThink. You can also listen on our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.